Maum Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prishnaya Puttale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namane Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pracharane Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Parishachari Satarane Maum Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prishnaya Puttale Srimate Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Niti Namane Sri Varshamaradi Devi Daya Daya Dupate Krishna Sambhara Vigyana Daya Nikopre Namaha Guru Orvala Prema Jashri Rukhi Noga Bhakti Rashi Gauri Kuruna Shakti Vigrahaya Namo Sute Namaste Gurvani Shimurtai Dinitarine Rupanu Kavirudha Prasiddhanta Dhvanta Harine Namo Kore Kishwaraya Shakshak Vairagya Murtai Vipulamni Sankore Param Mujaya Tenama Namo Bhakti Vinodaya Sat Chitta Ananda Namne Gaur Shakti Swarupaya Rupanu Kavirudha Te Gaur Vibhava Kume Swam Nirvilishta Sat Jana Priya Vaishnava Sarva Goma Shri Jagantai Tenama Pancha Kalpatru Vishta Krita Sindhu Vyevacha Patitana Pavane Vyo Vaishnava Vyo Namo Namah Namo Mahavadnyaya Krishna Premipadaya Te Krishnaya Krishna Chaitanya Namani Gauri Vishnama Pancha Tattvamakam Krishna Bhakta Rupa Srupakam Bhakti Avatara Bhakti Akhyam Namani Bhakti Shaktikam He Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dina Bandhu Jagatpate Gopesh Gopita Kandadara Kandana Mosute Jaya Damsura Turpam Gaur Mama Mandir Matera Krati Matsa Vasha Param Bhojau Shri Radhavana Mahanavi Vedvendara Nekalpatru Madakshimat Naga Shinhashastho Shri Shri Vara Shri Lago Vindeva Prashtala Viseva Manus Marami Shri Mangla Sarasaram Vivaan Shiva Tata Tasta Takarshan Venu Svarayam Gopi Yer Gopi Nata Shri Sattra Kanchana Gopuram Deva Deva Navani Shri Prishavana Suti Devi Pranamami Hari Priya Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nichananda Shri Advaita Karatha Shri Vasa Gauda Bhakta Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Ram Hare Ram 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 Hare 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 Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Ram Hare Ram 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 Hare 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 Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Ram Hare Ram 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 Hare Hare Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
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 Narayanam Namaskritya Naram Chaiva Narottamam Divim Saraswatim Vyasam Tato Jaya Mudirayat. Before reciting the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is our great means of conquest, we should offer our respectful obeisances under the personality of Godhead, Lord Narayan, unto Nara Narayan Rishi, the supermost human being, unto Mother Saraswati, the goddess of learning, and unto Srila Vyasadeva, the author. So this morning we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 5, Chapter 18, Text Number 26, which is on the board. Kindly repeat this verse after me, while you're online. Antar
Bahisakilan.
Darumayim.
Darumayim.
Made of wood.
Made of wood.
Nara.
Nara.
A man.
A man.
Striyam.
Striyam.
A doll.
A doll.
Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, Sri Bhaktivedanta Swami, Sri Prabhupada Ki
Jai.
My dear Lord, just as a puppeteer controls his dancing dolls and a husband controls his wife, your lordship controls all the living entities in the universe, such as the brahmanas, kshatriyas, vaishyas, and shudras. Although you are in everyone's heart as a supreme witness and commander, and are outside everyone as well, the so-called leaders of societies, communities, and countries cannot realize you. Only those who hear the vibration of the Vedic mantras can appreciate you. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is Antar Bahi, present within and without everything. One must overcome the delusion caused by the Lord's external energy and realize His presence both externally and internally. In the Srimad Bhagavatam 1.8.19, Srimati Kunti Devi has explained that Krishna appears in this world nato natyat dharu yata, exactly like an actor dressed as a player. In Bhagavad Gita 18.61, Krishna says, Ishvara sarva-bhutanam hrid-deshe arjuna tishtati. The Supreme Lord is situated in everyone's heart, O Arjuna. The Lord is situated within everyone's heart and outside as well. Within the heart, He is the super soul, the incarnation who acts as the advisor and witness. Yet although God is residing within their hearts, foolish people say, I cannot see God. Please show Him to me. So I just comment on this first paragraph. There's two more paragraphs. So Srila Prabhupada concludes this paragraph by saying that foolish people say, I cannot see God. Please show Him to me. So not only can they not see God, First of all, they cannot even see their own selves. There's a, you see this word in the second line, Aprishta Rupa. So in the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, in an explanation of the evidence, it is an explanation of logical evidence for the existence of the soul, or the fact that we are not these bodies. The person is not the material body, but actually the person is a spiritual being. So in that verse, there's also a very similar word, actually the same word, adrishta shruta. Adrishta means the soul cannot be seen. Drishta, drishti means vision or power to see something. So when something is adrishta, it's beyond our power of vision. And adrishta shruti means also not only you cannot see it, but you cannot hear it. Shruta means to hear. So, atapara, avyakta, this verse says that the real person, he is para, he is beyond, or para also means transcendental, avyakta, para avyakta, beyond the unmanifest realm. Now we are in this, let's say, dimension, use a pseudo-scientific word, dimension of manifest material energy. So we are seeing, hearing, perceiving with our senses only matter. So if one, by power of meditation or speculation, goes beyond sense perception, this gross sense perception, he enters a realm called avyakta. Avyakta means unmanifest. And that may be the realm of pradhan, which is unmanifest material energy, which Shukadeva Goswami says one can only understand, he uses the term shunyavat, just like we say the Buddhist philosophy is shunyavada. So shunyavat, it is just void, a void condition. Or beyond that, if one is more adept in subtle perceptions and meditation, one may enter the impersonal Brahma. And that is also avyakta. There's nothing there to be seen or felt or heard. It's simply light, pure white light, spiritual energy. So, atapara avyakta, the person, this the actual person, the spiritual person within the heart, his existence can only be perceived beyond that avyakta. And so it is a drishta shruti. Drishta shruti means he cannot be seen and cannot be heard. Avyuda guna brimitam, his existence is beyond the influence of the modes of nature. What we are now, what we know ourselves to be now, is simply a product of the combination of the three modes of material nature. Our physical form, our mental makeup, our intellect, even our false ego. Everything that we think we are, that we hold as, you know, so dear, someone insults us or someone wants to engage us in some way, and we say, you don't understand me. What is this understanding? What does this mean? It is just an illusion of mind. So, Bhagavatam says very clearly that abhyuta munabhrimita, that person that you are is beyond the modes. He cannot be seen. And yet, adrishta shruti vastuvat. The word vastuvat means something is there. Don't think that the conclusion is, well, I'm nothing. If I can't be seen, if I can't be heard, if it's even beyond objective, then what can be there? No, vastu. Vastu means reality. Or substance, real substance. So adrishta shruti vastuvat. There is something there. Of a higher or highest reality. But right now we cannot see, we cannot hear it. But how, so then how can we know that we do exist beyond not only material world, but even beyond the unmanifested realm? So, sajivo yat punar vet. Because there is an eternal person there. Therefore, the jiva, the living entity, when we understand in this material world,
through gross senses and mind, we understand that there are living beings here, although we cannot actually see them in their true form. But we can know that the jivas are there in their true form because there is repeated birth and death. If there was, if we were only matter, then why would there be continuity? This is a very profound point. Just like, as an example, there is a mango farmer, and he has planted in his land mango seeds. And these seeds have grown up into trees. So now he has a nice grove of mango trees. Now one night a thief steals into the mango grove with a big sack, and he fills it up with mangoes. And then he goes trotting off somewhere, but he gets caught. Gets caught maybe trying to sell the mangoes later. So then police arrest him, and there's investigation. So the mango seller is there, the mango grower, he's there being interviewed, and the thief is there. And so the mango grower says, this man, he stole my mangoes. He's been coming again and again in the night and stealing mangoes, and I want him punished. And then the mango thief replies as his defense that this man has no claim over these mangoes. He could not make a legal claim because all he did was put seeds in the ground. He could have claim on the original seeds, but those seeds grew up into trees, and those trees bore fruit, and I stole the fruit of the trees. What does that have to do with him? So this sounds like a very intelligent argument, but I assure you in a court of law it will not be accepted. Because there is a principle of continuity in everything. It is understood by everyone that the seed grows into the tree and there is a continuity. It is actually the same entity. The same entity. It was once a seed, now is a tree, and gives fruit. So, in the same way, the external form of the living entity, life after life, may change very radically. One life he's a human being, the next life he's a mongoose or an aardvark or something like that. So that's a very, very radical change. The modes of nature have changed his self-conceptions, his mentality, his physical form. Completely. But continuity can still be traced out, just like continuity. What is an apparent relationship, at least if you examine with this drishti, with this vision we have? What is the relationship between a seed and a tree bearing fruit? Who can see the connection? Just by looking with these eyes. But by intelligence, by logic, we can understand. So similarly, Bhagavatam says, there must be a subtle person because there is repeated birth and death. So now, it is said here that people are questioning, I cannot see God, please show him to me. Well, you cannot even see yourself, Prabhupada said, that very nice example. You cannot even remember yourself as having been in the womb of your mother. Even if they will say, I'm not sure, reincarnation or transmigration is a fact. Well, at least we can give this example. You don't remember that you were within the womb of your mother, but were you there? Yes, by logic and reasoning, you must admit you were there. So you cannot remember, you cannot see that now. But you must admit that you were there. Similarly, from this example, we can understand there's continuity, there must be a subtle being behind this changing form of matter. So now, we are not aware of ourselves as we are. We are certainly not in control of these material elements as they are forming and reforming these material bodies we get. We know definitely that we did not ask for this body. Everybody, when they look in the mirror, they're dissatisfied. That's universal experience. We always wish that we had been given another color eyes or hair or a smaller nose or whatever. So we're not in control of this. So then who is? You see, this is the next question. There's certainly a plan. If there's continuity, then there's certainly a plan. If there's karma, which gives us our just deserts from one life to the next, then who is behind that? All this is subject matter for a person whose brain works properly. A person who has good intelligence will delve into these matters. And the answer is given here. Sa Ishvarastvam. You, Supreme Lord, are He, Saha. The Ishvara, the controller. Ishvara Sarvabhutanam Pradeshi Arjuna Tishtasi. The Supreme Lord, Ishvara, is situated within the hearts of all living beings. He is seated next to that true identity, that spiritual being in the heart. Krishna sees that true form of ourselves eternally. And because Krishna sees us as we are, Krishna loves us so much. This is actually a very wonderful point. We become disgusted with ourselves in this material world, as I said, look in the mirror, ugh. And then when we try to do anything, we always make so many mistakes, and we be, ugh, I'm so stupid. And other people come and tell us, ugh, you're so useless. So we can become so depressed in this material. Except for a few brief moments sometimes, we become jacked up on the false ego, you see, false ego fix. And then we crash down again in depression. Generally, the material existence means depression. But Krishna, then if we're so bad, if we're so nasty, why does Krishna remain in the heart? Even when we fall down, we become mongooses or lobsters or crabs or things like that, very nasty, ugly creatures. No one wants to have anything to do with it. If you see some scorpion or some big tarantula, you shrink away and cry, ah, horrible. But we should know that we were also in these forms, and we can go in these forms again. But Krishna's always with us. Even if we fall down the most nasty creature, because Krishna is seeing it. Krishna, of course, he has this drishti, angani asyasa kalindriya vishtimati pashanti panti kalyanti chiram jagati. By his vision, by his drishti, he is producing, maintaining, and annihilating all the universes. It is said by Raghava Goswami in a very nice book he has written that the universes are being generated and maintained and destroyed by the Lord's jnana shakti, power of vision. Everything is happening in the sight of the Lord. It's like it says in the Upanishad, Sa'aikshita. The Lord sees, He looks, He glances, and then this material existence comes into being from His glance. So time factor springs from the glance, from the drishti of Krishna, and sets everything into motion, and maintains it, and destroys it. And then it is recreated again. So Krishna has the drishti to see us as we actually are. And as we actually are, we are most beautiful in the sight of Krishna. Krishna wants our love. Krishna is thinking, this living entity is so nice. And because actually, it is said in the Bible, for instance, man is created in the image of God. But that's a very distant, reflected, and perverted image. The real thing is the soul. That's the real person. And like Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, the spirit soul is actually an expansion, a direct expansion of Krishna. Minute, but nonetheless, all the wonderful qualities of Godhead are there in very small form. So for one who has spiritual vision, and Krishna is the first among those who have spiritual vision, from him spiritual vision emanates and is shared by everyone else who has spiritual vision. So for one who has spiritual vision, the soul is most beautiful to look upon. So Krishna is seeing us in the heart, and he's there giving us intelligence by which We can come to him if we want. But as Prabhupada says, you see, Krishna is in the heart and he is always transmitting the message, love me, love God. And we are distorting this message into love dogs. The impetus to love is coming from Supersoul, but we pervert it. We aim it, we refocus it on gross material elements, and thus we become entangled. So, the point I was making is, what to speak of not being able to see God in the heart, we can't even see ourselves. If we could see ourselves as we really are, then we would understand we have no other purpose except to serve and love Krishna. So continuing the purport, Srila Prabhupada writes, everyone is under the control of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, exactly like dancing dolls controlled by a puppeteer or a woman controlled by her husband. A woman is compared to a doll, Darumayi, because she has no independence. She should always be controlled by a man. Still, due to false prestige, a class of women wants to remain independent. What to speak of women? All living entities are Prakriti, female, and therefore dependent on the Supreme Lord, as Krishna himself explains in Bhagavad Gita, Aparyam, Itastvanyam Prakritim Vidhi Meh Param. The living entity is never independent. Under all circumstances, he is dependent on the mercy of the Lord. The Lord creates social divisions of human society, Brahmanas, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, and Shudras, and ordains that they follow rules and regulations suited to their particular position. In this way, all members of society remain always under the Supreme Lord's control. Still, some people foolishly deny the existence of God. So, again, speaking in terms of logic and reason, it can be easily established. It has been established even in the history of European philosophy, right, by philosophers as far back as the Greeks, the Middle Age, Christian scholastic philosophers like Thomas Aquinas and so on. Many, many philosophers up to the modern time have established by logic and reason that there must be a supreme control. There must be an intelligent source to everything. They have established that we are dependent. We are under control. That is our experience. Of course, there are other philosophers who are actually deluded. They are trying to foment in society, foment means agitate, a spirit of atheism and independence. But this is all false. So their logic is very weak, actually. But they may be good in jumbling words. And so they create this sort of in Kali Yuga, they're given facility by the personality of Kali to create a steady drumbeat of propaganda. And in this way, infect people's minds with doubt. Because people are very prone to sense gratification in this age. And sense gratification, the facility becomes very widespread, very easy for everyone to break the regulative principles and not even feel guilty about it. And feel that this is just the natural way of life. And so by doing this, the intelligence becomes reduced. We become more and more absorbed in bodily conception. And thus, due to this ignorance, we fall easy prey to these very poor excuses for philosophers in the modern time. We're just making propaganda, not really on any logical basis. But they're just making a steady drumbeat of propaganda. There is no God, you are God. Just like there was one pundit, Bhagavan Pandit, and he was much beloved by the king because he was very, very intelligent. So the king, although Bhagavan Pandit was not really part of the royal court, the king had his own ministers, own pundits were his ministers. But Bhagavan Pandit was always being invited by the king to come and talk with him, tell him stories, give him instruction. King just very much liked to hear from this pundit. So practically every day the pundit was coming, and when he would come, whatever was going on, the king would stop, he would send the ministers away, all right, let's break himself down. Come in, Bhagavan, sit down here, tell me something. You see, and all the ministers became Indians. The king actually, he likes this pundit who's an outsider much more than he likes us. So they decided to make a conspiracy so that the pundit could never enter the king's presence again. So they told the palace guards that the king does not want Bhagavan Pandit to come in his palace again. So the guards, who just obey orders without thinking, they said, yes, very good. So when Bhagavan Pandit came, then the guards on either side of the door with their spears, they put the spears together.
You cannot enter.
And he was trying to talk to them, but I always come here. The king always wants me to come.
No, no, we have received order. You cannot enter.
So then Bhagavan Pandit, he was loitering out in the garden. And every day he was coming, because he was suspecting some conspiracy, he was thinking. He understood that these pundits, ministers, were envious. He thought maybe they have made some conspiracy against him. So he would just wait in the garden, because he knows the king will come out on a walk one of these days, and then I can see him. So king, he noticed that Bhagavan Pandit hadn't come today. So he was unhappy. And he said, where's Bhagavan Pandit? And the ministers said, well, we're very sorry, Your Majesty. We didn't want to break this news to you, but since you're asking, Bhagavan Pandit has died. And then they produced a fake medical certificate from the royal physician. They got him in the conspiracy too. And he said he's died of such and such disease. So the king was very unhappy, very morose for a couple of days. And then one day he decided to go out and get some air. So he left his palace. So Bhagavan Pandit was in the garden. Saw the king coming out. So he thought, oh, here's my chance. But all the ministers were with the king. So when the ministers saw Bhagavan Pandit coming, they made a tight knot, a crowd around the king. So the king couldn't see Bhagavan Pandit. He was trying to enter this way, but the ministers kept putting their shoulders together. And he couldn't get in between them. So the king didn't know he was there. So finally Bhagavan Pandit, he climbed a tree. And from the tree he was shouting, oh my dear king, here's your loyal Bhagavan Pandit. Here I am, here I am. And the ministers, they went, oh, oh no. And then they turned to the king. Your Majesty, we have to leave this garden immediately. Just see, that is the ghost of Bhagavan Pandit. And then the king thought, oh, no, this is inauspicious. All right, let us go in the palace immediately. He turned around and went in the palace, and Bhagavan Pandit concluded, oh, I suppose the king really doesn't want to see me. Because although I have shown myself to him, he has turned and walked away. And so he left that country and never returned again. So, but this was all the result of some conspiracy on the part of these clever ministers. They convinced the king that this was not Bhagavan Pandit in the flesh, but it was a ghost. So, in the same way, clever demons, foolish, spiritually foolish, but materially clever demons, sort of assumed positions of leadership, influence in society. They're doing that. They made a conspiracy. You know, just like nowadays, if a politician would happen to say in the media, in television, that he's a firm believer in God, and I'm talking about practically anywhere in the world, maybe not India, but even in India, the politicians. Actually, I can speak on one interview, that will be interesting. I'll mention this in a moment. There are many, politicians, they will not make any mention of God in their speeches. Because if they do, then they're immediately considered weird. Because of this ghostly propaganda that has been spread throughout society. See, speaking about God is like seeing a ghost. You know, you might as well come on TV, politician, and say, last night I saw a ghost in my room. And people will think, oh, well, I'm not going to vote for him. Or he might say, last week I was taken up in a flying saucer and the entities examined me. He would never win an election if he said like that. And now it's come to the level that he says, I believe in God. I believe that we're all parts and parcels of the Supreme Lord, and our only mission in life is to serve Him. People will say, uh-oh. This guy is a crackpot. He won't get our vote. This is all the result of ghostly propaganda. And even in India, I read an interview by one Bal Thackeray, I think his name is. He's the leader of the Shiv Sain movement, Shiv Sain political party, which is supposedly militant Hindu movement. They're saying, you know, they're always preaching Muslims have become too strong in India, and we want to get back to the Hinduism and to the Vedas. And it seems superficially that this is a very nice trend in Indian society. And but then the reporter was asking him, I didn't ask him directly. You know, so this is another, if he was a devotee, he might say, yes, sometimes I'm thinking of Krishna. But what he said was, well, but when my wife cuts onions in the kitchen, then I'm crying. So, this character is supposed to be, you know, stuff. I mean, people take him as a sort of religious figure or a defender of religion. And that's on the interview, we can see he's a completely mundane person with no apparent interest in God whatsoever. And all these answers, you know, they're sort of funny quips. When I only cry when my wife cuts onion, so on and so forth. This is just, again, to make people laugh and think, ah, he's a nice guy. He's normal like me. I'll vote for him. He eats onions. He's not a fanatic. So we'll continue. Last paragraph. Self-realization means to understand one's subordinate position in relation to the Lord. When one is thus enlightened, he surrenders to the Supreme Personality of Godhead and is liberated from the clutches of material energy. In other words, unless one surrenders to the lotus feet of the Lord, the material energy in its many varieties will continue to control him. No one in the material world can deny that he is under control. The Supreme Lord Narayan, who is beyond this material existence, controls everyone. The following Vedic mantra confirms this point. Eko ha vai Narayana asi. Foolish persons think Narayana to be on the platform of ordinary material existence. Because they do not realize the natural constitutional position of the living entity, they concoct names like Doridra Narayan, Swami Narayan, or Nitya Narayan. However, Narayan is actually the supreme controller of everyone. This understanding is self-realization. So, to know Krishna, to know God, one must be in a position to receive the mercy of Krishna. So that means one has to be free of material bondage. Yesham tvanta gatam papa jananam punya karma te dvanva mohanya mohanya yeva janji dhritta yataha. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita that to be fixed in bhajan or fixed in devotional service, beyond the influence of material energy, one has to be, number one, free of all sinful reactions. Number two, have amassed a stock of pious activities, but not materially pious activities, which are called karma mukhi, and then there's jnana mukhi. These are pious activities which nurture karma or jnana. But there's bhakti. Bhakti Unmukhi, the kind of pious activities like watering Tulasi Devi, visiting Holy Dham, Mayapur, Vrindavan, engaging in service to the deity, serving the lotus feet of pure devotee, chanting the holy name of the Lord, taking Mahaprasada. So one has to amass great heaps of this sort of piety. And then Krishna says, te dvanga moha nirvukta. One has to be free from duality. One has to be, not be seeing this material world in terms of sense gratification, which means some aspects of the material world we like because it will afford a sense gratification. And other aspects of material existence we avoid because it is opposed to our sense gratification. So this is duality. When one is plunged in this duality, then he falls into an endless network of confusion and delusion and problems, trying to struggle to set this duality right. Anyway, so what Krishna is saying is one has to be free from material contact. So, Srila Prabhupada uses the term material bondage. Now it's interesting that one is bound to this material nature by his desire. We have fallen into this material cage because of our desire. Bhaktivinoda Thakur compares material existence to a cage for trapping animals. You can trap birds. I have one friend who used to raise pigeons. He used to like to keep pigeons in a cage, and he would catch pigeons by placing a cardboard box on a stick with a string tied to it, and then he would put corn there. So the foolish pigeons would come and eat the corn, and they would follow the corn underneath the cardboard box, which was tipped up. And as soon as they got underneath, from a distance he would pull the string, and the box would drop, and then we have the next pigeon. He would catch it and put it in the cage. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur has explained in one song, our imprisonment in this Maya Pashe, he calls it, which means the cage of Maya, in the same way that this cage was baited with sense gratification, and therefore we have come. It's by our desire, willingly, like these foolish birds, we entered that cage, and then the door snapped shut. We've been trapped for uncountable births since that time. So, to receive the mercy of Krishna, the true mercy of Krishna, by which you can understand Krishna as the supreme, beloved, the only lovable, worshipable object, Prananath, the Lord of our lives, and we can dedicate ourselves to him completely. With full determination, with no distraction from anywhere. So to receive that mercy, one has to change his desire. One has to let go of his of the embrace of material nature. Just like there's a story of one beggar who was very thin and hungry and sickly. So he was standing outside of a temple, a big temple. And because he was so weak, he was supporting himself by embracing a pillar on the outside. He had his arms around the pillar like this. And he was hanging, so weak. So one rich man was on his way to the temple and saw this poor beggar in ragged clothes, so weak and decrepit, almost falling on his face. So he weren't clinging to that pillar. So the rich man thought, well, let me show some compassion. So he bought some Mahaprasad outside the temple. They had a stall selling Mahaprasad. So he bought Mahaprasad and he came to the poor man and he wanted to place it in his hands. Please take this. So the poor man is clinging to the pillar and didn't want to let go. So then the poor man, he just held out his hand like this from around the pillar. And the rich man put the Mahaprasada there. And the rich man stood back to watch, what is he going to do now? And so the poor man was trying to stretch his neck around the side of the pillar to eat the Mahaprasada. But of course, he couldn't do it. His neck doesn't stretch that far. So the rich man thought, and for no purpose at all, I have bought this Mahaprasad, because this man is so foolish. Although I put it right into his hand, because he won't let go of that pillar, he cannot take it. So he just went in the temple, leaving him struggling. So this story is told to illustrate the conditioned soul, who's very firmly embracing the pillar of Maya. So when even the pure devotee, or Krishna himself, comes to give his mercy, his real mercy, such persons are unable to take, even if it's put right in their hand. And they take some ridiculous method to try and get, you know, enjoy that mercy. That means the method they take is elevationism or salvationism. They try to exploit the mercy of the Lord for these two purposes. Elevationism means, they think mercy means to become materially elevated. In this life, to become rich and fat and happy, enjoying sense gratification, like anything. And then in the next life, going to heaven and enjoying there. So to become elevated and mature, this is what they think. Or salvation, that means after climbing up this mountain of elevation, which actually, what does it mean? It means worshipping God or accepting the mercy of God with a view to become Krishna. This is why they cannot actually take, you know, they're like that foolish man who can't eat the Mahaprabhu, because the mercy is, you become my servant. Krishna comes and says, now I grant you the power and authority to be my servant. Come on. He's invited. He's displaying his lila. His devotees are there, ecstatic, transcendentalists, who are always displaying such wonderful emotions of love of Godhead. Their association is so purifying. And they're inviting these wonderful Vaishnavas, the conditioned souls, come on, here there's a place free in Krishna's service. You come on. Come on and take your place. Here's some ecstatic service we're just rendering. Here, come on, make this garland, pick these flowers, do this arti, distribute these books, do something, chant Hare Krishna. And Krishna is there. Yes, I will accept your service. You can also become my intimate servant. But they want to become Krishna. Therefore, they're like that man trying to stretch his hand. There's the mercy right in the hand. And then they're thinking, well, this is God's mercy, then let me use it to become Krishna. And that's impossible. So I pointed this out. You see, I've seen religions around the world. They like to worship some avatar or some acharya who shows himself to be most austere, sense-controlled. Like in the West, Jesus Christ, he's always depicted hanging on the cross with a thorn of crowns, bleeding here from the Roman spear, and he arose from the dead, so he's very, very powerful to endure such suffering for our sins, and then 3 days later rise from the dead. So he's certainly powerful. And I've seen the Hindus who worship Lord Shiva, they offer him shoes with nails driven up from the bottom. Here, my dear Lord, wear these shoes. This way you prove to us that you're powerful, just like Jesus proved that he's powerful by hanging on the cross with nails in his hands and feet. Well, that we can believe. If he can do things like that, then he must be the one who's qualified to give us what we want. So they like to see the acharya or the avatar whom they worship, very austere, with nails in the feet, like Lord Shiva, sitting on ice, meditating. And what do they want from him? He's got power. And what do they want from him? Let me dance with my girlfriend under the shining full moon. Let me play out my musical instruments and attract all the young girls. Maybe not flute, maybe guitar. Anyway. You study their psychology. They just want to be Krishna. And they worship Krishna's representative, the avatar, for that purpose. So, it's like climbing a mountain. You're going through so many rituals, troublesome rituals, performing austerity, so on and so forth. Like climbing a mountain, hoping that at the top, then I will become God. But before they get to the top, they fall off. They slip and they fall inevitably. This is the karma kandiya process. You can go up very far, but sooner or later, inevitably, you will make a slip and you will fall. And then all sorts of sinful karmic reactions will begin to accrue. That means one is falling into hell. And then one shifts into the salvation phase. Help! Save me! As he's falling. So if he's successful in his salvationism, then he gets a nice soft landing at the bottom. And then he's very humble. Oh, I'm sorry. Then he sees the mountain. Actually, I should try this other path. And then he tries again. So throughout all eternity, climbing, climbing, getting near the top. Oh, the peak is in sight. Oh yeah, there's the flute, there's the peacock feather, the crown, everything there for me. Ah! Help, help, save me, I'll be good. Oh, I'm so sinful, so fallen. Oh, such a rotten soul am I. Oh, I'm going to be very good now. I'm just going to worship God, be his servant. I didn't see that happen. So in this way, and this mentioned here, Daridra Narayan, Swami Narayan, Mitya Narayan. Probably showing some real humor here. Daridra Narayan means poor Narayan. This is a policy that has come about in India after this Vivekananda. Because he was just a nationalist, another mundane Hindu nationalist dressed up as a Swami. And he was using religious sentiment to unleash some sort of social program in India. He was even before Gandhi did that too. So Vivekananda, he invented this phrase, Daridra Narayan, which means Narayan has become the beggar in the street. Daridra means poor, beggar. So his preaching was that there's no need to go to the temple and make offerings to the deity. You see, just like you have here in front of the deity of Iskand temple, we have this donation box where people can come and place some money for the deity. But Vivekananda's preaching is, what is the use of giving money to Lakshmi Narayan or Dhana Narayan? He's wealthy. He has all the money he needs. He doesn't need your donation. Give it to the poor man in the street. Because according to our Mayavadi philosophy, everybody is God. So God has appeared on the street as a beggar. And he truly deserves your donation. So Daridra Narayan. And then Swami Narayan. This is, so there's some movement called Swami Narayan in Western India, and it's some man, some sort of preacher who appeared a couple hundred years ago. He's accepted by them. He's an ordinary man, but he's accepted by them as being Narayan, Swami Narayan. And then Nitya Narayan, actually I'm not really sure where that comes from, but Nitya means illusion. So some philosophy of illusory Narayan, but what this all means is, and this is like the last word in frustration of this climbing the mountain, falling off, climbing the mountain, falling off. And now they become so frustrated. I'm not going to climb this mountain. I'm just going to declare myself Daridra Narayan at the bottom of the mountain. He's become God. Poor man, dog in the street. Now he's God. By decree, by some propaganda, public decree. So, when society becomes so insane, then yes, someone may be able to enjoy this brief life as Narayan, even though he's very poor, miserly, niggardly dressed, complete fool. Society may become so deranged that such a person may be accepted as Narayan. It's a fact. It goes on. It's going on. That will take us off the track, but there are, have already been in Bengal, incarnations of God. I mean, persons who are accepted as incarnations of God by many, many people on the strength of their being poor and wretched. But I don't want to get into this. It's a whole thing that takes us off the track. But it's a fact. It's going on. So, but this is like the story of the blue jackal. You see, there was a jackal. And the jackal is despised among all the creatures of the jungle. Because jackal just slinks behind the lion. He's a beggar. He slinks behind the lion. The lion kills and eats something and leaves some bones with a little flesh on it. And the jackal comes and gnaws on the bones. You see, he won't kill his own food. He's too cowardly to eat the meanings of others. So he's despised by all living entities. So once the jackal was running through the forest, and there was some washerman who had set out, he'd been washing some clothes, and he was going to dye them blue. So he had a big vat of blue dye. And the jackal, running along, happened to fall into this vat of dye. So he came out, he was all blue. And so he ran into the forest, he was very bewildered. Now I'm all blue. Oh no, what does this mean? So, but then when he came among the other animals, they saw this blue animal. And then the animals, they were being suddenly very respectful. They were paying their obeisances. They were saying, "Who are you, sir?" And the jackal understood. "Oh, they don't recognize me anymore." And then he said, "I am the Supreme." And they were all very, "Oh, then we will put you on a throne and worship you." So everyone, even the lion, even the great lion, the elephant, the great animals of the forest, they were there. They had the jackal on the throne, and they were making a puja, and they were bringing offerings, and he was there with a crown, and he was giving orders, and he was really having a good time. And then it just so happened, after a few days, a pack of jackals in the distance. You see, right in the middle of puja, they were doing blue puja, singing the song. The blue jackal is there on its own. And then in the distance, a pack of jackals started to howl. And, you know, these doggish entities, when they hear this howling, then this jackal, he went, "Whoa!" His crown fell off, and all the animals were looking, "Wait a minute, it's just a jackal!" And they tore him to pieces. So temporarily, you see, if society becomes so stupid, one can become declared God simply by falling into a vat of blue dye, or being able to make ashes come from his hand, or something like that. Or just being poor, being very poor. So in Kali Yuga society, he may be able to enjoy an exalted position for some short time, but then afterwards he will be torn to pieces by the Amadutas. So this is certainly not receiving the mercy of Krishna. So what does it mean to receive the mercy of Krishna? That is explained in the translation, last sentence by Srila Prabhupada. "Only those who hear the vibration of the Vedic mantras can appreciate you." Now, appreciate Krishna in terms of this verse, he's described here as Ishwara. So, people today in the Kali Yuga, they do not appreciate that they are under control. They do not like to think like that. They do not want to admit
Well, this is the demonstration here. I'm going to do the control here.
So they do not want to admit, they do not like the idea that they are under control, that they are servant, that they have to follow laws. No, everyone is, not everyone, but most people are trying to assert their independence. And there was an upstart philosopher who conceived of a philosophy that was a kind of protest against control of material nature. He wanted to, by philosophy, erase any idea that the human being is under control of material nature, to speak of God. So one day he was musing over his philosophy, and he thought, of all the aspects of nature, the sky gives the most trouble to the human being, because out of the sky comes rain, torrential rains, comes lightning, comes hurricanes, comes tornadoes, comes snowfall, comes cold weather, comes all sorts of problems come out of the sky. So he was thinking like that, and he was becoming very angry. Oh, this rascal sky! And then he jumped up from his seat, and he began to punch at the sky. He was dancing and hopping. You rascal sky! Take this! Take this! And he was jumping and hopping and leaping, trying to grab at the sky, punch it, kick it. And finally he fell exhausted to the ground. He had sprained his arms and legs. They were all painful. He was laying there, puffing for breath. And this guy, of course, didn't pay any mind to this person. This guy remained as it is. This guy. So, like that, people today, they protest against any idea that they're under control. But their protestations are all ridiculous. Very amusing, actually. So, people, you all probably have experience, devotees, the reaction of the arrogant, beastly men of today. Why do you bow down to idols? And why do women sit in the back, and why do they have to be shy and cover their head? And why do you work without any money, getting money, getting paid? What about your healthy sex life? So on and so forth. They're accusing the devotees of being slaves. But actually, Srila Prabhupada said, that is the proper position. It's not actually slavery, but Srila Prabhupada gave the nice example of good son. The relationship between a father and son is very natural and healthy. When the father loves the son and the son loves the father, then there is a natural inclination for the father to care for his son by giving good direction, by protecting his son, giving him proper upbringing. And there is a natural tendency on the part of the son to be very obedient to his father. And Srila Prabhupada said, this relationship is also very, very enjoyable, because they protest. They protest that you have to enjoy life. You Hare Krishnas are not enjoying. You see, you're just acting as slaves. To enjoy, you have to be free, do what you like. But Srila Prabhupada explained that when a father and son have a nice, loving relationship, then when the son wants to enjoy something, Prabhupada gave this example, for instance, the son wants to go to some cinema, some movie, then he will ask his father, "My dear father, this film is playing in town, I would like to see it. Can we see it?" And father will say, "Yes, let's see it together." So they actually enjoy doing things together. So father will take the son to the movie, will buy him popcorn, will pay for the tickets. Father is there always protecting the boy. There may be some rowdy kids, as there often are, standing on the street in front of the theater, and if the boy would come alone, they would beat him up and take his ticket money. But when they see him with father, they stand back. So the boy can just walk very confidently with his father. Look at these boys. So, you see, this is very nice. So Srila Prabhupada explained, the devotee of Krishna, he loves Krishna, Krishna loves his devotee, and together they enjoy. The devotee, he takes this willing and loving subordinate position because this affords him protection, Krishna's protection. Moreover, it affords him a very sweet and intimate relationship with the Lord. He's enjoying so many varieties of exchanges with Krishna. Whereas the upstart, he has no relationship with Krishna, and he has no protection from the material energy. So, it's a very vain endeavor to try to become the independent enjoyer of this material world. One is simply cut down by material nature. But anyway, the materialists are often very persistent. They do not have good sense. They're like the beasts. But for those with intelligence, and they can use their brain in such a way to, as I explained in the beginning of the lecture, first of all, understand their own position. What we are, we are not the body, and we are servants of Krishna. And then, as Srila Prabhupada is explaining here, to go on to understand that Krishna, the Supreme Lord, is right there in the heart. And that our relationship with him is eternal, and it is very natural. We are already serving. If we deny to serve Krishna, then we have to serve his material energy, which is a thankless service. We are repaid only in birth, old age, disease, death. So it is a very simple matter of shifting our service over to the Supreme Lord and becoming liberated from this material existence, going back home, back to Godhead. So I'll stop here. Your Prabhupada is the name of Krishna, Guru Shokha. He is the only name, because he's the only controller, the only enjoyer. Those are considered the prerogatives of the male, that he's controller and he's enjoyer. And female is controlled and enjoyed. That's the idea. Of course, the reality is completely opposite. Because this is the world of Maya. See, so Maya is predominant. Material energy is what's predominant. And the foolish living entities are trying to be Purusha. Actually, they're Prakriti, but they're trying to be Purusha. And this is a hallucinatory endeavor. So they're dreaming that they're in control of enjoy, but they're not. They're being controlled. And they're being enjoyed. So anyway, this statement that we are Prakriti is just a statement of our tattva, of our position in reality. It does not necessarily mean that we have a spiritual female form, but we are predominated by Krishna. So if we assume our proper position as servants of Krishna, then, yes, then we may attain a female form or another spiritual form. But in any case, that's our proper position to be servants of Krishna. Yeah? Yes, well. Yes. In what way can the soul is pure and unpossible? That is because the soul is there to supply us with enjoyment. Yes, well, the soul is compared to a spark. So the spark is always sparked with pure consciousness, so it's always brilliant with consciousness. But the contamination assembles around the spiritual spark. This Chaito Darpanamarjana, this statement by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, says the mirror of the mind becomes covered with dust. So when you look into a mirror, You're seeing the reflection of yourself. Now, if there's some mark on the mirror across your face, you know, some mark of dust, streak of dust or something, it may appear that your face is dirty when you look in the mirror. Oh, wait, oh, that's on the glass, that's on my face. That's because you're seeing only reflection. So the mirror of the mind has been explained by Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur. It means the mirror of consciousness. And consciousness appears in this conditioned state as the mind. Consciousness is the symptom of the soul. So consciousness is like the rays of the soul. So in those rays of awareness, the impurities in the form of anartha bijas or sinful desires for unwanted sense gratification, they assemble around the soul. So when we look into the reflection of consciousness, we can, it's like this expression, at least in the English language, when you say you reflect on a problem, or you reflect on your situation, or you reflect on yourself, it means you think about yourself. It means you're using your consciousness to think about yourself. So, or think about something. So we rely on consciousness to form our perceptions, our understanding of things. So if the consciousness is impure, then it's, Lord Chaitanya explains, it's like looking into a dirty mirror. You can't see anything except dirt. So in the same way, when we use our intelligence or use our consciousness now, we come up with all sorts of nasty, degraded impressions, which are embedded there from our karma, from so many births in this world, so many attempts to enjoy sense gratification. It's all buried there in our consciousness. So we cannot reflect upon our actual self. We can only reflect upon activities of sense gratification and the illusory self of this material body. So if we could penetrate beyond this covering of dirt and filth in the consciousness, then we could reflect upon ourselves, our real self. Therefore, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, we should engage in Sri Krishna Sankirtan that cleanses the heart or cleanses the consciousness of all the dust accumulated for many, many years, many, many lifetimes together. When the consciousness becomes pure, then you can see your real self. Now that real self, pure self, original self, is always there. It's just the consciousness that it has become pure. Any other questions?
In this example that you gave, then there must have been some separation. Like, if you feel consciousness like a pure mirror, and now you look from outside, how have you come outside? To be on the other side of the dust. If you are actually pure, you always are also in the dust somewhere else, and you are there. So how come? What happened?
No, but the awareness, or the cognizance, the cognizance is taking place in the consciousness. Just like now, we understand from Shastra that the mind, the root of the mind is the heart. But when we think, and it's all taking place in the head. And Shastra says the mind is in the heart. So that's because awareness has been projected into the brain. The brain is some sort of biological computer, if you will, if you like this example. And it requires an operator. So the consciousness is projected into the head to manipulate the brain. So therefore we think that thinking is taking place up there. But the brain is, you see, the brain is tuned to operate this body and to assimilate material perceptions. So it's just a site of conditioning. And we're identifying with that conditioning because we want to enjoy matter. So therefore we think I am thinking up here. But actually we are thinking down here. Does that make it more clear?
No, it makes it work. But if you're actually thinking down there, then we should always be thinking online.
Yes.
Well, you are in your original state because the super soul is there. As I said, Prabhupada explained like this, that the super soul is giving us the proper inspiration to love him, to turn to him. That's the statement of the Shastra. There are two birds, and one is just waiting, observing, and waiting for the other one to turn to him. But this other one has become fascinated by the fruits in the tree. The fruits in the tree means the opportunities of sense gratification in this body. Now the thing is that, you see, Maya is there. Maybe you have to work Maya into this equation. It makes it more clear. It's not just us and our consciousness, but Maya is there. And Srila Prabhupada said, Maya is the potency of Krishna. Very, very powerful, much more powerful than us. So Maya, when we have the slightest desire to enjoy separately from Krishna, in other words, there is Krishna and Krishna is inviting us, come on, serve me, love me. But we become just slightly distracted somewhere in our consciousness that maybe there's something else. So immediately, Maya seduces us. Maya, because she is the very potency of Krishna, she knows right away that we have this desire, and right away she gives opportunity for us to act on that desire. And thus we become distracted. And we become conditioned, we become bound. It's not just a matter of something happening on the mental plane. You know, you're like drifting off into a daydream and then suddenly snap, oh wait, this is all illusion. You know, once you get into it, then it's like endless, and that's the meaning, nityabhata, endlessly conditioned. Exactly, she's a virus. You know, viruses are also inconceivable. I read about one that's come out, computer virus, that cannot be detected. It cannot be detected by any virus program. It's impossible to detect. There's no program that can be written for it. I think it's called Destruction Engine or something. It has some interesting name. Well, this is a good example. You know, the operator is there, he's typing away, but then there's something else happening on the screen. But it's maybe not such a good example because he doesn't want that to happen. But the thing is that, or maybe he does. You know, because he's a cheater. Maybe it's like this. Because he was a cheater, he got a free program from somewhere that he should have paid for. And there was a virus on board on the diskette, and therefore it wrecked his machine. So like that. There's some illicit desire. And Maya comes along and says, oh, yeah, no problem. But then there's a hidden clause in the contract. I'll provide you the sense gratification now, but you have to pay me back throughout all eternity. And then we find ourselves, it's impossible to break that contract. Only Krishna can break the cord. And yet,
you mentioned this here, as you mentioned about the Brahman, and we don't have any sense of seeing or hearing that there's a divine light. Have you actually experienced any divine light?
The nature of the our nature is consciousness. So consciousness is the you could say primeval perception. But consciousness, either in the material world or spiritual world, it becomes channeled by senses. So senses are a natural expansion. Actually, expansion of consciousness. I'm even talking to these computer models. I'm giving it to this kind of way. They expand consciousness, or yes, they enhance the original function of the consciousness, which is simply awareness. When it says the constitutional, what is it? The constitutional position. This phrase probably uses the spirit soul is the 1/10,000th tip of the hair. That means without any enhancement. It's just a spiritual spark with this raw consciousness. So the senses are added or are extended.
give direction to the consciousness, give purpose, like the pogonist, you might say. And then it actually has some function, either spiritual function to serve Krishna, or material function to enjoy material existence. So, this Brahma Jnana process, meditation, strips away the material enhancement of consciousness. And then you just have raw awareness. And so that awareness, when it becomes completely free from even the subtle or unmanifest matter, and then it just appears as brilliant light. And that's not seen. I mean, that's not really seen. Just like, you know, if you have a light at night. Now, if you shine the light this way, then you can see. But if you look at it, you know, if you turn it and just brilliant light in your own eyes, you don't see anything. You know, if you walk around in the forest with a powerful torch, right, you know, pointed right at your own pupil, just like not having any light at all, you'll just as well bump into, you know, a tree and fall down a well. You have no light at all. So it's not really seen. The light of awareness has to be properly directed, and for that you need senses, either spiritual or material. Shall we stop now? Srila Prabhupada ki jai.